Succession number 28750, Reel 21.
Laurie Manton, Reel 20. So how long have you been engaged with oral history, Laurie?
Well, I first started getting involved in recording people's memories back in about 1982 when I started recording some of my relatives' memories of the Second World War, because I had what I presume was a standard childhood during the 50s and 60s. Say I was 6 or 7 in 1956-57, and my parents always talked about the war, what happened on the home front, and what happened with my father when he was serving in Burma. So I'd always been interested right from early age. I'd always say, can you tell me the story about the doodlebug landing at Frimley in Surrey and things like this? Maintain this interest. And then I kept meeting people who had been in the war. And in those days, people who had been in the war were people who were in the First World War, because they were coming up to retirement age, which is astonishing. And that would really have been the time to start interviewing these people. But certainly in more professional terms, in 1985, I got a job with the Totnes Community Archive in Totnes in Devon.
Oh, this is just Slapton Sands you were telling me about.
Yeah, it was a community archive, and it was owned by Devon County Council. And you took the long-term unemployed and used them to record local history, but at the same time bring them back their work confidence, because they'd be like typing things that are working in an office environment. So we had teams of long-term unemployed who would be indexing the Totnes Times newspaper from 1960 to 1860, because we had the bound volumes there. Others would be going around collecting old photographs to copy and old postcards from people across a very wide area of the South Hams. And we had a team of half a dozen oral historians who were going out and interviewing people. And of course, oral history and recording was becoming part of my life at that time. And they did a great deal of work on the South Hams. Managed to find any number of people who'd been evacuated from the South Hams during the war to make way for the American rehearsals for the D-Day landings. But at that time, and just prior to that, there had only been one thing written about Slapton and the war, and that was The Land That Changed Its Face by Grace Bradbury, which was a really readable account of it. And back in 1976, when I left the army, my parents had already moved to Devon a year previously. And I arrived home in August 76, before the end of the summer-long drought that they'd had. And the freshwater side of Slapton Sands had dried up to a certain extent. And there were weapons and US soldiers webbing just lying on dried up stream beds and such like. And then it came to pass that Ken Small, the local sort of entrepreneur, identified for the first time this Sherman tank, which had been there all along and lots of people knew about, but he at least managed to get it raised and produce a really good memorial on the beach. But these are all that is still to come, but with our author historians going out, And it was quite interesting because a lot of these tapes were not going to be given public access to for 30 years for one reason or another. But we came across a pair of gentlewomen who lived out in the countryside in the South Hams, who during the Second World War, when the Americans were there, decided a good way to make extra money would be to charge for their personal services and acted as prostitutes for American officers and the like, and I think made a considerable amount of money, in a particular sort of black market, so to speak. And what was remarkable was the level of openness of these two respectable ladies. I think primarily because they knew that it wouldn't be opened up until they were probably long dead. But to them it was a matter-of-fact thing that they did, and they had no guilt or worries about what they did. You know, it was wartime after all. And I thought that was really interesting, getting people to do things like that. And there's, I've taken over the years more and more interest in oral history and looked at the work of Studs Terkel. And there's a marvellous chap who's not so much on the television now, but was, and that's Stephen Humphreys, who interviews people. So they're filmed oral histories. Secret Life of Sex and things like this. But because I've been involved in oral history, when I started reporting for Soldier magazine and started coming across old soldiers, of course, not having trained as a journalist, my approach to interviewing people was an oral history approach rather than journalistically. So I wanted their whole story.
And so what's the difference, would you say? What is your oral history approach? This is what...
Well, if you're a reporter, if you were going to report a jumble sow, you'd go along and say, right, jumble sow is in aid of so-and-so, it raised this much, it took place there. So it's the who, what, where, when, how, and why. And that's it. But if it was all in oral history terms, you'd find out who started the jumble sow. Has the jumble sow changed over the years? What have been the high points? What have been the low points and such like? So, surprisingly, over recent years, Soldier magazine had not carried interviews with people, and there were loads of them around. And I literally thought of just about every personality and politician I could think of, checked in my copies of Who's Who, to see if any had served in the military. And the first one I came up with was Enoch Powell. And I wrote to him, and I said, you know, I'd like to interview you about your wartime experiences. I work for Soldier magazine. And I got a nice handwritten letter back from him saying, do come next Tuesday to my house in London. And I turned up with a photographer, and I'd done my research beforehand. I'd gone very carefully through Who's Who to see where he'd been. And I knew that he'd been the youngest brigadier in the British Army at one time. What I hadn't realised was how big a part he played in the success of the war, especially in North Africa and in the Far East. And I start chatting away, and when he greeted me, he said, it's only yesterday when I threw the BBC journalist out of my house for asking silly questions. So I'm chatting away, and he's starting to relax a bit, and he suddenly starts telling me this story about being involved working with the results of Enigma. And so in North Africa, he was on Monty's staff at a distance, but he was getting all the Enigma reports concerning all German air and naval activity in the Mediterranean. So he knew very quickly when the German fighters were going to come over to bomb, and where their ships were and when any of their ships were moving. So he was able to say, so-and-so is going to be bombed in a couple of hours' time, or there is a German convoy here, or there are E-boats there. And then they had to decide, because they couldn't react to everything, otherwise the Germans would have known that Enigma was being read. Well, and that wasn't commonly understood was the fact that they had to sacrifice some people by knowing they were going to be attacked but not letting them know. And I thought, God, this man is interesting. I'm still taking the oral history approach. And then he said, let me take you back to the beginning. He said, I was Professor of Greek at Sydney University, came back immediately on the outbreak of war, enlisted, became a Lance Corporal, and shortly they said, go to officer training unit and become an officer. And he said, I went on from there. So having been in Africa, they sent him out to the Far East, working in a sort of behind-the-scenes intelligence role. And it was very difficult to work out what Japanese forces you were fighting, because they didn't have a regimental system like we had. So you couldn't say, oh, it's the Argyll and Southern Highlanders over there and the Queen's Lancashire Regiment over there, and know something about their capabilities. And the British managed to get hold of a Japanese army list. And he took over a gymnasium in Burma and asked for 50 people. And they translated all the names onto cards and laid out the whole Japanese army list on the floor of the gymnasium. And from there, they were able to identify from documentation from dead Japanese whether those dead Japanese were in the army list as infantry, artillery, what have you, and they could work out which Japanese capabilities and which part of the front that they're up against. So it made life easier when they were wanting to attack them or find soft spots, like logistics areas. And
I better not go into too much of the detail of what you were doing. It's more what you were learning of oral history. Now, that tape, for instance, where could one listen to that of Enoch Powell?
Nowhere but my home at the moment. Yeah. I've got all the tapes stored at home. But in taking that oral history approach, one found out much more than you would do journalistically. For example, by looking at the whole of the person's history, no journalist, and he'd been interviewed by hundreds over the years, no journalist had discovered that he kept his old wartime brigadier's uniform in his wardrobe and intended to be buried in it when he died, which caused a big cause célèbre when it appeared in Soldier magazine. But by drawing it out, or history-wise, that fact was uncovered.
So how do you draw things out of people, if you are an oral historian?
Well, I think you listen to what people are saying. And when you ask them a question, and you get the answer, and then you wait, and there's a big gap, and they feel they have to say something else, and what they haven't told you then comes out as well. So you've got twice the story you would have had by saying, oh, fine, thanks, because there was more to tell. They just initially come out with the select a small selection of things that they think you want to hear. But it's quite difficult, and in chatting to these people, you know, like Field Marshal or Bramall, in chatting to him, taking the slow oral history side of things out, suddenly, for one reason or another, he found himself in reliving being an army cadet at Sandhurst and marching up and down his living room. Now, bear in mind, this man was head of the British Army, well, he was head of all the forces at the MOD, but he's marching up and down like a child, calling out orders to himself, drilling himself in his own front room. This is a man in his 70s, showing what it was like. And he became young and giggly and all the rest of it. And then progressing the story through slowly and asking the right questions, suddenly talks about landing in France. I said, and you know, was it an exciting time? Yes, it was. And what did you do? And then suddenly he said, we came under fire, and my best friend and I rolled under a truck for cover, and the bomb went off beside. And I looked, and my friend was dead, you know, torn to pieces, and me being next to him protected me. Now, he hadn't talked about that to other people, but using the oral history approach has triggered and brought to the surface a lot of these memories. But there's the difficult bit, because now you've got Field Marshal Lord Bramall crying, because he really is reliving the moment when his friend died all these years later. And that's when you have to start being careful that you could dig too deep in using the oral history approach. And it was the same with Spike Milligan, because suddenly he said, it's no good, I was a coward, I was blown up and I ran away, and I feel so guilty, and he's sort of leaning into me, my shame, and you know, I left my comrades, and people knew he'd been blown up, but they didn't really appreciate the circumstances of what had happened to him. You know, keep going up and down the hill, and instead of saying, I went up the hill to take some supplies to the lookout and got blown in the air by a mortar bomb, he was living it all over again, which we wouldn't get from straight reporting. Occasionally, the person being interviewed realises that they've told more than they want to. John Frost of Arnhem, for example. He was very good. Once I released the inner General Frost, or the Colonel of Arnhem, you know, he was saying, oh, I respected those Germans so much, they were very good fighters and all this sort of thing, and he's going on and on about all the people dying around him and all the rest of it. And the whole thing was coming to life. But he realised what he'd been talking to me about. And as I was going, he just put a hand on my arm and said, you know, will you do me a big favour? Don't make an old man look stupid. Which I thought was very touching.
So what does that mean? That he expected you to edit that?
Well, I think he realised for once he'd given the whole story and was just worried that you know, well, if I'd been a journalist, I could have made great capital out of saying, you know, Frost of Arnhem said SS were brilliant. You know, the wrong sort of headlines. But he'd realised before I'd left him that I got so much out of him, whereas the others...
Because you were going to write these stories, unlike us, just storing them in an archive. Yes, I see. So they would have known that, and I can see.
Yeah, because I transcribe the whole story, and, you know, most of it appears in the story. So, you know, it's like a very lively transcript of an oral history tape, if you like.
But do you keep the entire tape? You don't edit pieces out of that? The spoken word, that is.
Normally it's chronological. I've always, in editing a magazine in recent years, it's always really annoyed me when people have just done a chronological thing, where they, and nowhere more so than the question actually appears there, and then the answer, question, answer, and I think that looks terrible. You know, I have to mould the whole thing into one article, if you like. She used to drive my editor mad. She got so slow. I said, yeah, but I'm not going to write a word until I've transcribed every single word. And once I've transcribed every single word, then I can write a brilliant account in that person's own word, as opposed to, you know, a series of little episodes. And I remember my editor saying to me, look, he said, if they're ugly and got pimples all over their face and the wallpaper is, you know, hanging down off the wall, then you should start your story as, I went to the home of a sad old war veteran. His nose was dribbling and he was partly shaven. The wallpaper hung down and the carpet had seen better days. And that's what he wanted, as setting the scene for an interview. And I said, that is terrible. That is absolutely terrible. Because not only you're starting off by being rude about the person's circumstances, whereas it's their story is the important thing. But doing oral history was certainly, that approach was getting so much more material that I call, you know, treasure, than straight question and answer, and not letting them, you know, keep interrupting them and things like
that. Yes, the importance of listening, really, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
And the more you listen, the more you get out of it. Just rarely you'll get someone who has actually got nothing to say, who, you know, and they are so boring. And, you know, who cares? And that is really difficult. But what they're actually saying, you know, it's valid. It's their personal impression of a war or, you know, some sort of conflict, which is, you know, can perhaps be compared with the gung-ho description of someone who really was fighting. Because I think they, you know, a huge percentage of people who were in the Second World War never fired a shot in anger. You know, so many more people behind the lines than the front line.
Do you ever have the feeling that people are not telling you what happened to them, but they're reading into that what they have since read about that situation, without perhaps consciously realising it? You know, talking of a battle or an event, not at that time when they were realising it, but what they've read, say, about the Battle of the Somme, on their actual experience.
Once or twice, and I've realised that very quickly, because before I interview a person who's been in a particular campaign, then I read up on that campaign.
How do you deal with that? Because I imagine it's not a good thing to correct people, as it were.
No, I wouldn't correct them, but I'd sort of change the emphasis of my, I say questioning, but, you know, steer them in a different direction. There's something I always used to say to every person I interviewed, normally at the end, and I'd say, what was the most exciting thing that happened to you during the war. And nine times out of ten, I get the most fantastic episodes of things that that happen. You know, Spike Milligan, it was, oh, the sight of the German cook trying to defend himself against our bullets with his tin utensils when we surprised them. But my mate shot him dead, and I told him off for doing that. But the next thing I'd say was, and what was your most depressing moment during the war? And people would come out with the most horrific incidents. But it hadn't come out during the interview. And often, either of those two could take you onto a completely different level. Sometimes it was right at the end, after an hour or so, that the whole thing would come to life. It really would. Yeah, I spoke to, I think I'd said previously about interviewing a brigadier in Brunei, who'd been in Malaya, Borneo, when they had the conflict out there. And he was telling me all the things he felt I should hear. You know, we beat the terrorists and all the rest of it. But I asked him something and he said, oh, should have been there. Every time we went up the line, we had to go past this buried insurgent, and his hand stuck out, and we used to shake his hand as he went by. It was attached to the Gurkhas. And he says, you know, a couple of weeks later, he said, going up the line, and I shook his hand and it came off. And it just came to life after that. But it was the perseverance of speaking to people. A most unsavoury tale. But that, you know, suddenly in that moment, from giving me the pat answers, which I could appreciate, it was this tremendous tale. And then, you know, he went on for 40 minutes with the most exciting accounts of fighting the insurgents in Indonesia and such like.
Well, Laurie, thank you very much indeed for telling me those few pearls about oral history and for all the other information you've given today. Thank you very much indeed. And that is the end of Reel 20.